There are two themes or words that sometimes are used in spiritual circles. And the two that I've been thinking about are remembering and forgetting. And sometimes people talk about the importance of forgetting the self. And sometimes remembering the truth or something. One of my favorite quotes in Buddhist literature comes from the Zen master Dogen, who wrote that to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to awaken with all things. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And for me, it's significant that it's in that order, that you don't bypass the part about studying oneself, that it's through the study of oneself, through being mindful of oneself, understanding one's mind, understanding one's body, understanding one's experience, that one has the experience of somehow forgetting the self, forgetting one's self-consciousness. And when that happens, there's a certain kind of intimacy that develops with the world around us. And Dogen says, we then awaken with all things. In some ways, we're not so separate from all things. And in Zen, sometimes in the old Zen stories from China, people seem to get gotten enlightened pretty easily back then. Anyway, there'd be these great stories, and the student would go to the master and say something, and the master would say something, and then they would say, and the student was enlightened. But if you go back and look at the Chinese, of the word that's usually translated as enlightened, the word is intimacy. The student became intimate. So there's something about intimacy in becoming aware, becoming awake. So Dogen talked about forgetting the self. A Pali or Buddhist word for mindfulness, that's usually translated as mindfulness in English, is sati, S-A-T-I. And the word itself, by itself, means or is very closely related to the word memory, to remember. And I like that quite a bit because I think part of what mindfulness is a kind of remembering, of bringing together all the members and parts of who we are into a kind of whole, a unified whole. And especially all the parts of our body, that mindfulness reintegrates the body, brings the members back together. So mindfulness is a remembering or a reminding. And I think it's said sometimes that perhaps mindfulness is not the best English translation of the word sati. And partly because it puts so much stress usually on the word mind. And I think we could probably just as validly translate it as bodyfulness. And sometimes I like to think of it even as heartfulness. And as many of you know, in Asian languages, the word for heart and mind is the same word. And I think Jack and James and Carol all devoted part of their talks to talking about what the purpose of this practice was, what we're doing here. And I wholeheartedly agree with everything I said. And having, you know, in case you had any doubts. But now that we've heard, you know, what the purpose is, I'll come along on the fourth day and say, I don't know. not quite so sure. But I love it. And that's it. I think that I had to explain to my father what I was doing. Actually, quite often he just couldn't get it. And in one of my attempts, I explained, you know, and I was quite sincere. This is the way I felt. And, you know, actually, it's a love affair that I have. It's a love affair, and that shut him up. Actually, he hasn't asked since. So, heartfulness. I think so. I feel often that way about the practice. And then, you know, are you going to ask what the purpose is then? If you're in love, you ask the purpose. So, mindfulness, bodyfulness, heartfulness. And it's also possible to put the stress on the last part of those words, on the fullness. And I think that's very valid also. Mindfulness is about experiencing the fullness of our life. Allowing ourselves, giving ourselves permission to feel the fullness of our life in all its different aspects. And the word fullness, or experiencing fully, being fully present, has been a very important kind of way of explaining the practice for me, to myself. And I'll say a story about a way that I practiced when I was in the monastery that taught me a lot about how to do meditation practice and about this fullness. Just before I went to the monastery, I was at some bookstore, and I pulled down from the bookshelf some book, and it was by Dafrijan. Back then he was called that, and I didn't really know who that was, but I just opened it, and I just read a paragraph, and he said something like, the basic human problem that we have is that we're always avoiding relationships, and you should investigate or find out how it is you avoiding being in relationships, avoid being intimate, being fully present. So I thought that made some sense. I kind of like that. I put the book back on the shelf, went to the monastery. Not because of the book, but actually, I spent a practice period. 5 months in a, this is an anecdote, I guess, sorry, in a Zen monastery in Japan. And I had this image of these Zen monks being really kind of samurai kind of spirit and Zen and real tough. And there was an element of that in the monastery. But one of the things that surprised me was I asked some of the younger monks why they came to the monastery, why they became Zen monks, what inspired them. And they said, oh, I read the books by Rajneesh. And here I come from California. And I hadn't actually read any books by Rajneesh, and they said, hey, you have to read a book by Rajneesh. And I had to kind of get this black market book, because, you know, you weren't supposed to read these books in the monastery. The abbot wasn't supposed to know. Anyway, so I went to the monastery after reading this little passage, and the way it was worded in the book was kind of in a negative frame. The problem is avoiding relationships. So I turned it around and kind of stated it more positively for myself, and made it my question as I went about my day: how could I be more fully involved with whatever I'm doing? And one of the first things that happened when I was in the monastery was they put me in the kitchen to work. And at first this was a great disappointment, because I'd gone to the monastery to do a lot of meditation, And if you're working in the kitchen, you can't meditate a lot. And Zen monasteries are great for that. You have an expectation. And Zen monastic life is made up to just not let any of your expectations follow through. So I had this expectation that where it was at was to sit, and they put me in the kitchen. And I learned a lot in the kitchen. It was a very rich experience for me, one of the richest practice experiences of my life. And I had there in the kitchen this question, you know, how can I participate more fully? And it was a great place to have this question because I had this repetitive work, chopping vegetables and onions and carrots. And that's a lot of what I did the first 3 months. I was a prep cook and I just chopped. And I would stand there by the table and I had this question, how can I be more fully with this carrot? And I would pay attention to my body and how I stood, and I was surprised how much I tended to kind of try to avoid the carrot. I'd pull back with the left part of my body, and you know, my left foot would be kind of back. And so I learned to kind of to pay attention to that and to kind of bring myself more fully right in front of the carrot. And then the same thing happens over a carrot as happens over a zafu. You know, the mind wanders away, and there's judgment, and carrots aren't big enough. I didn't cut it small enough. It's a lot going on in the kitchen. When I was kitchen manager, I told someone that the cucumbers were cut too small. And they cried. And left. Things are very intense in a monastery. So I learned a lot about my body. I learned a lot about my mind. And I kind of was always my question, you know, how can I do this more fully? How can I be more fullness with my experience? And that carried over into my meditation practice. And it was kind of, I didn't really kind of keep that question going in meditation, but somehow I got the physical feeling. It was kind of became kind of an embodied question or embodied kind of practice. And so I'd come to sit and I'd be the same thing. How can I be more fully sitting here? How can I be more fully participate with my experience as I sat? This Zen master Dogen, he also made the claim that we become awakened, we awaken and we become enlightened through the body and not through the mind. And I think that's often different than what most of us maybe would think if we were asked. And probably, as many of you know, there's a tremendous emphasis on mindfulness of the body in Buddhism. The Buddha, in the early sutras, repeatedly stresses mindfulness of the body. I think much more than any other practice, it's mindfulness of the body that he goes back to over and over again. And he makes statements like, "Oh monks, if there's only one practice that you were going to practice, you should practice mindfulness of the body." And another quote that I came across recently, the Buddha said, "There is no friend that can compare with mindfulness of the body. It's your best friend, mindfulness of the body." And one day I looked through the books in my bookshelf. I have a lot of Buddhist books. And I kind of looked through them and looked through the index. And I was surprised how many of the books on Buddhism in English, especially kind of studies on Buddhism, but even Dharma books, contain no mention of the body at all. And I think that's a great, maybe you know, it's a symptom of the imbalance of our culture that puts so much weight on the intellect and ideas. In one of my first retreats, Vipassana retreats, one of my early Vipassana retreats in Thailand, I was sitting at Wat Swan Mok, a place where Ajahn Buddhadasa is the abbot. And one of the venerable old monks of Thailand. And he wasn't teaching too much when I was there, but he gave the introductory talk of the retreat. And he gave a nice talk. I don't remember what he said during the talk. Kind of to inspire us. And then it was over, and he kind of dismissed us, and we all got up and kind of started to walk away. And I was standing close to him, or walking away kind of close to him. And then kind of as an afterthought, he said to us as we were leaving, don't do anything that takes you out of your body. And that kind of just, that penetrated. And I was really taken by that. Why did he say that? That seemed like a strange thing to say, I thought at the time. And I took it on for the 10-day retreat to try to stay in my body as much as I could. And as I paid attention, I was surprised, you know, how much I wasn't in my body. I was having great, not great, I was having, we're all having out-of-the-body experiences, much too much of the time, I think. That's not our problem. And I found that often, the way my thoughts worked, the kind of way I was caught up in my thinking, I was actually ahead of my body. I was actually somehow at my center of mental gravity, of my sense of identity or something, was kind of often a foot in front of me, and kind of reaching forward or projecting forward. And I just learned to pay attention to that and feel that and try to see if I can come back and bring my center of gravity back, you know, in the body where it belongs, perhaps. One of the basic teachings of Buddhism is that the mind and the body are unity, that they're a whole, and that they can't really be separated at all. They hold debate in the West about the mind-body debate. It kind of doesn't really exist in Buddhism because really the Buddhist psychology doesn't really allow for a sharp distinction between the two of them. They're really a whole, they're together. However, I think maybe because of that, because many parts of our mental and emotional life are painful to us, and we don't really want to pay attention to them, or we repress them, or ignore them, to the degree in which our emotional or mental life is repressed, to that degree I think we also repress or ignore our body. That as we suppress or ignore or avoid our emotions, the physical side, the physical aspect of those emotions is also then repressed or ignored. And often, reawakening the body involves a reawakening of our mental life, our emotional life. As we shut out our emotions, we shut out our body. There was a Utni reader issue some time ago, where the main article was titled "The Body: Friend, Foe, or Total Stranger," and that's often those three attitudes are attitudes that are often held. And I'm often somewhat surprised how many people in our culture actually have consider their body to be a foe, a problem, an enemy. And they really try to keep away from their body. Sometimes it's because of the religious upbringing. They don't feel they have permission to feel their body or to feel pleasure in their body. It was a great pleasure. It's been a great pleasure to me as a teacher, a couple of times during interviews, to be able to give someone permission to feel pleasure. I mean, it's such a basic thing, and we never would have thought that I needed to do that. That so as we practice mindfulness of the body, we awaken our capacity to feel, our sentiment, our senses. We're sentient beings. And I thought I'd mention a little bit about how we often avoid being in our body. And one way, a fairly common way, is simply through avoidance. Just simply not paying attention, avoiding it. And sometimes thinking a lot, just being obsessed with one's thoughts, thinking about all kinds of things to kind of as a distraction, is a way of actually distracting ourselves from our body. Another way that I thought I'd just mention is fairly common also, and it's also common to people who are kind of older yogis, people who have been practicing for a long time. And I think every person who has any experience in sitting and develop some ability to be calm and concentrated succumbs to this the temptation of using their ability to get concentrated to avoid their body in some way. I assume probably everybody has, because it's so tempting. You have a little bit, some pain comes up in the body, and then I'm going to concentrate on my breath really sharply. I know if I do that, I'll just, you know, shut out what's going on in my body. I've done that. And I didn't even realize what I was doing. It's so insidious, so subtle, a seduction. And sometimes people have a lot of experience in sitting, will use certain possible experiences of emptiness as a hiding place to hide from experiencing your body, using the calm, concentration, or emptiness of sitting. And we have a tremendous capacity of avoiding pain and tendency to avoid pain and difficulties in our body, or joys in our body, pleasure. And aversion to pain in our body is a kind of an attachment. In my first Vipassana retreat in Thailand, my first Vipassana retreat at all, I sat for 10 weeks, not 10 days, 10 weeks. Not because I exactly wanted to, but I was waiting for a visa to go back to Japan. And the visa didn't come, and so I sat. And in the process, I fell in love with Vipassana, thanks to the Japanese embassy in Bangkok. But I had all this physical pain in my legs. My legs were just on fire. And I'd go to see my teacher, and I'd say, oh, my legs are on fire. And he'd say, are you noting it? And I'd say yes, and I'd tell him how I was aware of it. Then he'd say, well, look more carefully. And I'd go back, and I'd look more carefully. And I'd come the next day for interview and report how I was noting it more carefully. And say, it really hurts, I tell him. He'd say, well, look more carefully. And it went on for about 3 or 4 or 5 days. It was hurting more and more. And the teacher kept saying, look more carefully. And so then I was leaving, and the interpreter, who was a teacher who didn't speak English, the American interpreter said to me as I was leaving the abbot's quarters, he said, boy, you're really attached to your pain. And I kind of went, what? That's not at all true. And so I went back and thought about it. And I realized how much my aversion was an attachment. I was attached to not having pain. And when I realized that, then I brought my attention to the attachment, or actually I brought my attention more closely to the aversion. So whereas the teacher had kept telling me to pay more attention, I paid more attention to everything but my aversion. And once I could see the aversion, the attachment, it was much easier to have some equanimity, to feel it was okay to be there with the pain. So in developing mindfulness of the body, one of the things we're doing is developing a sense of self. And not in that maybe conventional way of talking about a sense of self, a self-concept so much, but literally a sense of self, a sensation, feeling or sensing who we are and what we are. Body consciousness is something which is one of the hallmarks of our culture, perhaps. Body consciousness in the sense of body image. We have, our culture puts a tremendous emphasis on body image. And I think we all know that. And that's having some consciousness of ourselves from the outside. And one of the things we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is cultivating body consciousness from the inside. What does it feel like from the inside? The vitality and warmth and loveliness of the body from the inside. At Santa Sabina, the retreat center in San Rafael, there's a sink in most of, I guess probably in all the bedrooms. And as is true above most sinks, there's kind of a bathroom cabinet. And the mirror is on the inside of the cabinet rather than the outside. So in order to look at yourself in the mirror, you have to open the cabinet and kind of look, kind of go like this. And you have to kind of do some work to look at yourself. And I think that was, it was built, it was originally built as a convent or a training seminary for nuns. And I guess they thought it was more conducive for the training of the nuns not to always look at yourself. And our body image is often tied in to how we experience both our body and our posture. And it's very valuable to begin paying attention to our posture and what's going on with our posture as we go about our daily life, to begin understanding better the kind of image we carry for ourselves and the kind of attitudes we carry through life. I'm still amazed to meet some people, and it's not so infrequent, where I try to have a conversation with them, we're standing, and I want to kind of face them more or less directly, and they turn 90 degrees to me. So I kind of turn around and kind of to face them directly, and they turn, and they kind of go around all the way in a circle. Somehow some people, you know, it's difficult to have, to be fully present or be to meet someone. Some people have a very strong sense of self, very rigid sense of self. And some people have very poor or almost no sense of who they are. There's a lot of boundary problems. It's my experience that mindfulness of the body is this great balancer. Mindfulness itself is a great balancer. It balances us. And for the people who have a very poor sense of self and very poor personal boundaries, mindfulness of the body and posture is a great way of bringing a stronger sense of boundaries and stronger sense of self. And for the people who have a very rigid sense of self, it works the same way, that as they develop more mindfulness of their body and their posture, some of the rigidity, some of the solid boundaries begin to dissolve a little bit. And you come to some kind of balance. So that the body, our body boundaries, are in some ways maybe neither open nor closed. Maybe, I don't know how to describe it. The body in some ways is more fluid with the environment, with some integrity also. You know. You know, when there's fear, when I feel fear, and I feel my body, you know, my body posture kind of collapses and I cave in and retreat. And if I feel it in my body and note it in my body, then that becomes part of my understanding. And it's still going on, but there isn't so much of the boundary problem because there's awareness, there's knowing. The body is a wonderful gate to the mind. Even though body mindfulness is a worthwhile practice in its own right, you learn a lot about the mind and how the mind works from cultivating mindfulness of the body. And one of the things I learned is that cultivating mindfulness of the body will serve you really well when you leave retreat, when you're trying to practice in everyday situations, in everyday life. On retreat often, especially if I'm sitting for a while, I can become very mindful of my thoughts. And a thought arises and I can become aware of it and see it and be there for it. But the mind is really fast. And in daily life, I just simply don't have that kind of sharp concentration or presence to catch every thought as they come up. And what I've learned to do is to pay attention to my body instead. And the body somehow responds slower and is often quite honest. And by paying attention to my body, when the body responds in some strong way, like my shoulders get tense, I use that as a cue to pay attention to what's going on, to kind of stop for a moment. Say, what's going on here? What's my reaction? What's my relationship with what's going on? How do I feel right now? I was in the UC Berkeley library a while ago, and I was looking for some obscure volumes of the Sanskrit sutras, and I had trouble finding them. I knew they were supposed to be in the library. They weren't checked out. And the librarians weren't being very helpful. I think it was budget problems at UC. So they were all harried, and I really needed this book for my research, and so I was kind of leaning across the desk trying to get them interested in my problem and trying to get them to kind of look more carefully and really feeling that they weren't really helping and feeling more kind of frustrated and a little bit angry. And finally a librarian came along who wanted to help, and so she took all of my information and she went away. And for a few minutes then I was left alone. And I have a little bit of a habit of being mindful. So as soon as she went away, I kind of said, what's going on? I dropped into my body. At first I found that I was leaning across the desk. And I felt all this heat and tightness in my cheeks. And I kind of stood upright. But I just paid attention to the tightness in my cheeks. I didn't do anything about it. I didn't try to relax it. I stayed there with it, just feeling it. And what I felt was that my cheeks were begging me for release. They were asking to be released. It wasn't like I had to release them so much. They wanted to be released. And so then I didn't really do much, but then with that recognition, this simple release happened in my cheeks. And at least, I think it's my experience, I don't know how it is for you, that if you pay very careful attention to your body, to the tightness and tensions in the body, often there's that sense that your body wants to be released. It wants its freedom. And often we don't have to do the releasing. I think one of the seductions of practice is, if you feel tightness or tension somewhere, is to relax. Is to actively relax. Try to relax. Spend some time trying to relax. And that's, in a way, a kind of an avoidance, perhaps, kind of trying to do something about it. I would suggest that it's much more radical, rather than just automatically relaxing when you feel some tension, is to stay there for a while and feel the tension, explore it and get to know it. Even if it's easy to relax, don't be such in a hurry. Just feel it and sense it, get to know it, see what's going on. And sometimes when you do that, the tension releases itself, and you're not the one who's doing it. Mindfulness of the body is also a very wonderful way of, well, through grounding ourselves in the body, through the concreteness of the body, of cutting through some of the identifications we have, just identifications in general, but also the kind of compulsive thinking that we have sometimes. One of the basic teachings of Buddhist psychology is that is a description of how the mind gets caught up in complicated abstractions that have very little to do with what's actually going on. And they'll describe how, starting with a very simple sense perception, we make an abstraction, we recognize it as something, and then we make associations about it, and from the associations we build ideas and concepts, and it goes on from there. So, for example, sitting here, I see this on the wall back there, there's this triangle. So first, you know, I see the shape, the color, and then I see, oh, it's a triangle. And then I think, oh, that looks like the frame that you use for ordering pool balls on a pool table. And, oh, pool. Oh, it'd be nice to play some pool. I haven't played pool in about 20 years. Maybe that'd be a good hobby to take up. I wonder, I have a friend who plays pool. We can go out, you know, after work and go drinking and play some pool. Wouldn't that be nice? And then, oh, but my wife, she's not going to like that at all. That wife of mine, she's always having these ideas about what I should do and what I shouldn't do. And why doesn't she get off my back? Boy, you know, it's all the time. I'm so angry with her. And then I notice, oh, I'm angry with my wife. That's the person I shouldn't be angry with. Oh, my God. And then I get angry with myself. And then what should I do about my anger? You know, and well, maybe I should go on a retreat. You know, and I'm always angry. I should go on a retreat, and that'll really make me calm. And then I can go back and deal with my wife, and maybe play some pool. You know, and all I was doing was looking at a triangle up there. It just goes on. Have you had that experience? And one of the ways that mindfulness works, one of the very important ways that it works, is we're trying always to reconnect us with the actual experience of what's going on. With the actual seeing, you know, the shape up there, the triangle, or the sensations of our breath, or sensations in our body. Just connecting, reconnecting with the basic ground of our experience. Not so much so we can stop abstracting, it's okay to abstract, but so we're not caught and lost in abstractions, and they go on and build, and have no more basis in reality. And reconnecting, coming back over and over again to the breath, coming back over and over again to the body, helps cut through all that in a very powerful way. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about thoughts and practicing the thoughts, some of my ideas about it, some of my thoughts and thoughts. As I think I said to my group today, I have kind of a friendly relationship to my thoughts, which surprised someone once. Someone came and kind of interviewed me after a long retreat, and I wanted to know how it went. And they said, what do you do about thoughts? Because that's kind of the classic question, right, that a lot of people are concerned about. And I said, I have a friendly relationship to my thoughts. And that kind of floored him. He was really surprised because he'd been struggling with his thoughts in meditation for years. thoughts aren't really a problem. Often the thoughts in the background. And just leave them in the background. If the foreground of your experience is your breath or something else is predominant, your body, it's fine to have thoughts just kind of in the background. Sometimes thoughts kind of enter the foreground and just noting them, just softly thinking, being aware of your thinking, removes some of the energy behind the thoughts. And then you can return to what's predominant. However, sometimes the thinking is obsessive. It just kind of goes on and just there doesn't seem to be any stopping it. And one of the things I found very useful to do then is to be mindful of the physicality of the thoughts, physicality of the thinking. That often, almost every experience we have has a physical aspect to it. And if the thoughts are quite subtle and there's not much oomph to them, maybe you don't, it's more difficult to see the physical side of them. But if there's a lot of energy in the thoughts, if there's compulsive thinking going on, there's often a physical component of the experience. And by becoming mindful of the physicality of that experience, there's a way of getting a handle on the thoughts and cutting through some identification that somehow lessens the compulsiveness, lessens the pull and the grab that thoughts have for us. And for me, I often experience it as kind of a tightness in the center of my head or a band around my forehead. And I'll just stay there and explore and be present for that band or that tightness or hardness in the center of my head. And again, I don't try necessarily to relax it, but I just try to stay there and feel it and sense it. And that cuts the identification of the thoughts often. I thought I wasn't going to have enough things to say, and I left all this stuff out, and it's about time to end. And I thought I'd end by going back to Zen Master Dogen. And Dogen, this monk, this Dogen, he talked about mindfulness also. And he said, mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. You might think about that a little bit. What is this mindfulness of the body? And who is it? Whose is it? And where is it? Where is your awareness? You ask yourself, where is awareness? Before I started practicing, if someone asked me that, I would have pointed here. And now, I point here. It's my torso. If I had to point someplace, you know, put on the spot, I'd say it's my torso. That's where awareness is. But where is it for you? Where do you find it? It's different from different people, different times. But Dogen says, mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. It's not that it's not that maybe that we are mindful, an act of mindfulness that we do, but we're allowing the body to be mindful. The body has its own mindfulness, and we are awakening the capacity of the body to be mindful. And maybe perhaps the body and mindfulness of the body are not two separate things, they're synonymous. There's not even a duality between them. Anyway, thank you. And I love mindfulness, as you probably can imagine. And I love mindfulness of the body. And I guess I hope that you will too. So thank you all. Let's sit just for maybe a minute together. So I hope that you all fall in love with mindfulness, but also you should realize that mindfulness is a very difficult lover. And mindfulness and I didn't always get along so well. It goes up and down, our tumultuous relationship. But over the years, we have a pretty good relationship.